it's really about who can sort of minimize the mistakes and make the least amount of mistakes and just sail a really smart series.
For the best Olympics coverage, subscribe to the OTB Highlights podcast feed on the OTB Sports app now.
Let's go back to a Go Loud original.
You also turned down contestant number two from The Office. That is, of course, David Brent.
Hey.
Come on.
Who the fuck's that?
Who are you? What have you been on before? Nothing, so don't...
Wanker.
You're the wanker, mate, if anyone is.
Who'd you think that went?
From my point of view, yeah, brilliant.
Hello and welcome to Let's Go Back to The Office Christmas Specials. My name is Owen Sheehan and every week myself and Sue Murphy go back and watch a film or a television show that has a particular meaning for that week's special guest. This week we are delighted to be joined by actor and comedian Eric Lawler. Eric, you're very welcome. How are things?
I'm very well, guys. I think we can all see light at the end of the tunnel now. So I think everybody's spirits are perked up. All we need now is the weather to perk up on there and we're laughing.
That would nice. That really would be nice. You come to the table. We gave you free rein to pick whatever you wanted here, movies-wise, TV-wise. In fairness, I don't think there's much that could have perked up our mood more than episodes 13 and 14 of The Office. This is the original Office for anybody just joining us. And anybody who's not au fait, when I say The Office, I mean the original Office. When I say The US Office, I mean The US Office. We're talking about The Office here. It's phenomenal, Eric. Thank you for bringing this to the table. Why did you pick it?
I was stumped. Because when you're given such choice as what's your favorite TV show or favorite film or whatever, and what's the stuff you go back to, I suppose it was more a sense of timing, and it was only recently that I had watched the episodes again in the last couple of months anyway, and I remember being so struck at how much I still loved it. And how fresh it still seemed to me and how much I enjoyed it. And I realized at the time that, you know, I must have watched this 10, 15 times now at this stage. And it still makes me laugh and it still makes me feel my feels, as all the young folks say. it's a roller coaster. It really is. And as I said, when I watched it again, I felt all those emotions again. And I can't wait to, revisit it again in another few months, because I still think it'll have the same impact on me.
Sue, did you feel the feels the first time, and did you feel the feels this week?
I am going to admit that I have never watched the UK Office in full.
What?
I know. It's terrible. I was actually saying to Owen earlier, I got a pull out of the UK Office, and you know those things that used to do in the papers and you get a DVD free, and I got two episodes, and I'd watched those two episodes, the first two episodes, and I was honestly like, this is so awkward. I just can't do this.
Well, you couldn't handle the cringe, could you not?
I was like, I can't. And I think it was like, we might get into it later, but I think it was because I worked in an office at the time that was that shit. Like, it was like, this is too much of a reflection of my actual life. I was in an office where there was a girl, like, literally, like, there, and she used to email me to, like, clean out the cupboard. It's like, you're sitting right fucking beside me. So when I watched it, I was like, no, I just can't do it. And I never went back to it. And my husband, when I say obsessed, like, he could actually like quote the entire episode start to finish. Like, when I was watching it with him last night, I kept looking at him for when the awkward scenes were coming up, because he just kept going,
oh, bracing himself.
And I was like, no, can't do this.
That's an interesting point. It's like, it's interesting that people actually cringe physically when they come up to those scenes. For me, it's like rubbing my hands together. I'm like, I cannot wait for this. Like, I'm not sure what's your bodily reaction, Eric, when you know what's about to happen at certain moments.
It's almost like an affectionate cringe. Mm. I know it's coming, and I know I'm going to cringe, but it's a cringe of love, as opposed to the initial forced cringe of, oh my God. David Brent is like Ricky Gervais. You know, he's quite a divisive comedian. But to me, I think he's a genius, absolute genius. And his performance of Brent throughout the whole series, and particularly in those two episodes, is just pitch perfect. He's everything in that show. He's the pantomime villain. He's the hero. I suppose if you want to call him a despicable man, you're rooting for him. He is the underdog. I think everybody sees a little bit of themselves in him. And as Sue alluded to there, you know, it brings us back to places and situations that we might have found ourselves in the past, and we can identify with them. And I think that's why we cringe so much, because we remember that feeling. I used to work in an office myself, and a lot of those situations that came up in that show, and particularly in the Christmas episodes, I remember all too well. I was a very young David Brent. I used to work many, many years ago. I used to work for a company called Lotus Development, who were bought over by IBM eventually, and I worked with them for many, many years. But before IBM took over, I was on a temporary contract as an 18, 19-year-old with Lotus Development. And it was just manual labor. It was assembly line work. It was stores work. And I had a contract for a couple of months, and they let you go, and then they bring you back for another couple of months, and that's the way it was. But when they used to let me go, I used to pop back up into the office. I'd pop back up to the factory to see people. Now, I didn't bring a dog in or anything like that, the way Brent does. But I just missed the people so much that I used to just pop in and say hello, and the guys were like, oh, all right, yeah, how's it going, Eric, and all that. And I was delighted to. I mean, it worked in my favour in the end, because eventually the people at Lotus made me permanent. So I was always there. But
we better give this guy a job. He's been like,
we might as well pay him for being here. So I could understand, I could feel, I could identify with Brent when he kept going back to the office just to touch base, you know. Now, come here, I wasn't as tragic as Brent was, you know, but then I can identify with things like that, and all the little office politics that go on, and you know, I mean, I started off as a physical labourer in the factories, and then moved, got promoted, and moved on up the chain of command and into the offices, you know, where I had to dress nice and do all that stuff, and I ended up staying there for about 20 years or so, like, you know, before I pursued the entertainment industry with the vigour that I'm pursuing it with.
It's interesting, isn't it, at the end when Tim kind of has one of those feels moments when he's like, well, you spend 8 hours a day with your work colleagues, and it's just all of a sudden you're thrown into this collective mix of people, and some of them are going to have no connection to you except for the fact that you walk on the same patch of carpet together. Like, I'm sure for anybody who's had a job, it's kind of like, yeah, that does hit home.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, there's an old saying as well, is that you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family, nor can you choose your workmates.
Yeah.
You know, and Tim, like, is such a brilliant character as well. And like that moment at the end, guys, with Don and him, is like, it's up there with one of the greatest, I think, romantic, feel good, emotional moments ever put on film, I think, genuinely. Like, because if you've watched that whole series, you've seen the torture that those two characters go through. You know that they really, really like each other. You see Dawn, and she's kind of trapped in this awful relationship with this Neanderthal man who doesn't allow her to pursue her dreams and passions, and is quite dismissive of her. He's basically, you know, he's of the idea, I'm the worker, you stay at home, have babies, and, you know, I'll provide for you. And Tim, who just recognizes how beautiful Dawn is inside and out, and what she's capable of, and you're just like, oh my God. And the whole series, that pain is there for us. You just want them to get together. And then right at the end, they do. And it's like, oh my God. I mean, like a tear. Like, I almost felt tearful when I first saw it happen. And even again, watching it again and again, I get a lump in my throat when it happens, you know. It's beautiful.
It's really interesting because, like, I guess when we look at this in the wider context of the series, so as I say at the top, it's episode 13 and 14 of The Office, the penultimate episode, the final episode of The Office, the last two episodes ever made, released in Christmas 2003. And that's a very deliberate thing, that there was going to be no more than this, that they wanted to tie up loose ends, that they didn't want to string this thing out. And sometimes with those sort of stories, as you say, connection with two people, you start to become more familiar with them over 3, 4, 5 seasons. To be able to take us into that over 30, 40 minute episodes, tops, for 12 episodes, is an unbelievable achievement, really. And like, I often wonder sometimes, is it because it is comedy that we have an emotional reaction to what's happening in front of us? And then all of a sudden, once they turn the dial on whatever emotion, even if it's not humor, we're going to feel something again. And I wonder if that's actually at play here in those closing scenes, as you mentioned.
It could very well be, Owen. As you mentioned there, like, is comedy maybe opening us up to other feelings as well? I mean, there's some beautiful moments in that particular episode as well. Some heartbreaking moments where you see Brent on his own in these roadside cafes, just looking so lonely. And your heart goes out to him, like, you know. And then, of course, he comes in, he meets the people, and he makes a fool of himself again. He's back to being Brent. But then you go, and you just see when he's... It was those moments when he's on his own in the roadside cafes that I felt, like, genuinely really sad for him. And you're kind of going, And then things turn for him as well at the end of those episodes. I think what we should point out as well to anybody who hasn't seen The Office, and I didn't think there was anybody, but Sue has proved me wrong, but people who haven't seen The Office UK, what we should point out is that episodes 13 and 14 are 3 years after, supposed to be 3 years after, the first 12 episodes were filmed. And it is a catch-up of where all the people in Vernon Hogg are. And of course, Brent no longer works in Wernham Hogg anymore. He was kind of sacked, and Neil is now running the show. His nemesis, who ran the Swindon branch. Yeah,
it's a perfect little segue there, because we should go through these first two, or these last two episodes in chronological form. I think we will go maybe not so much scene by scene here over the course of the next little while, but certainly moment by moment, especially over the first episode, because the first episode, a lot of stuff happens, which is absolutely hilarious. And then the second episode is kind of more of a mishmash of everybody's emotions, I think. So, as you say, we start at this point that is long after the end of episode 12. This is one of those revisited. It's like, I don't know, at your service, once Francis Brennan goes back and catches up with somebody in a hotel. How are you been getting on? Jeez, you haven't been painting that wall, that sort of thing. But they're back to see how David Brent and co. are getting on. And David Brent is not happy with how he turned out on the show. You headbutt a girl on the telly and you're labeled a prat. And he is like maintaining that he is not a plonker. And like the scene is set, it's just this brilliant, like that's a genius idea to say that this is going to be the terms of engagement, where there is going to be this sense of ego that has been fulfilled, where he's like offering his signature to be his autograph to people. And he's also really upset with how he was portrayed. It adds a whole other layer to David Brent.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, as you say, you just made me laugh there. You accidentally headbutt a girl on TV and all of a sudden that's the story. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And as you say, it sets the tone for the rest of the episode. He's become, in the meantime, he's become some sort of a traveling salesman where he's trying to sell cleaning products. But obviously tries to make it sound more flash than it actually is. Oh, flash, excuse the pun. oh my God, even though I'd only watched it recently, you've just made me realise how amazing that opening scene is. Oh, brilliant.
It's just so good. Like, I mean, the becoming a cleaning salesman is like, I like, there are so many moments that you can pick here.
But it's so perfectly timed as well, that joke where he's like, your one asked him from behind the camera, are you a door to door salesman? And he's literally taking the cleaning products out of the car. And he's like, no. Like, all of that stuff is just timed to perfection, you know?
It's like, my favorite moment in the two episodes is when he makes that sales pitch for his cleaning products, and he like goes through the stuff, and then he gets to the cloth and he's like, just gonna dip this in there. Oh, it's nearly dry. And then he's like, circular motion is key. That's coming off with tap water. It's about removing the stain job, not the paint job. And it's just line after line after line. It's an absolute cracker in that office. And your man's like, yeah, I'll take 12.
12. I'll take 12. And then the classic line after that. Tell me, who does your tampons?
Yeah.
What? Oh my god, it's so good.
This sort of journey towards finding fulfillment, that is where the tone is set. Like, as you mentioned, Dawn is a massive part of the story early on. We get a view of Florida, but we also get a view of Tim without her in the office, like locking Gareth into his office, which is now his office, and it's just not funny to the new receptionist whatsoever. She's having none of it. We get a look at the Fruit and Veg Emporium, as David puts it, and he's like, you need to stay healthy when you're on the road, and he essentially forces his autograph down the throat of someone. Like, it is interesting, like, this sort of paranoia that comes with being famous all of a sudden, that this guy has a massive ego and all of a sudden he feels that people are recognizing him. There's probably a whole other level of paranoid David Brent that we're seeing here.
Oh, for sure. He wants to be recognized, and then at the same time he wants to be recognized and praised and revered and loved, because he is recognized by some people go, you're not Pratt, and he's like, rude, not true. It's classic French, you know. I keep finding moments in Brent's character that I can identify with, and you know, like being in a soap that I was in, and I was on Fair City, and I got very kind of well known. People would know me physically, I suppose. Not now with the long hair, but anyway. But I used to get known physically walking around, and people go, "Oh my God, you're your man on Fair City." And I'll be honest with you, it was nice. It was a thrill. I enjoyed it. And sometimes when you're walking down the street and somebody goes, "Oh, there he is," you're like, "How are you doing?" And they think you're somebody else, and it's quite heartbreaking. It really is. It's damaging to your ego. So I can think. I think because of Brent, I identify so much with a lot of what happens to Brent, and I think that's probably at the root of why I love him so much, and I'm rooting for him straight away. You know. Sorry, I just went off on a tangent there.
No, because like there's a load in that I want to get into. Like once we get to the stand-up comedy version of David Brent later on, I'm really keen to get some of your insights into clubs that you've attended where you've seen moments like that a little bit later on once we get there. But just on that, like, I guess, is there ever a moment when you're like, does that person recognize me? Does that person not recognize me? That sort of in-between place that David Brent is all of a sudden negotiating here, this newfound fame that he doesn't really know what to do with.
I think you see, the difference is I'm doing it maybe internally. He's doing it. Well, he's vocalizing it, you know. there's also another thing. People will, you know, people of relatively small fame like myself will tell you, is that there's also people who do recognize you, but go out of their way to tell you that they don't recognize you. That's a really odd thing I've seen. Mm. So, you know.
How do you mean?
I'll tell you. I'll give you an example. I was maybe at a gig or at a festival, whatever. And a couple of people would come up and they'd go, "How you doing, Eric? Blah blah blah. Saw you at such a gig. Oh, watch you on Fair City. Can we get a quick picture?" And you go, "Yeah, no problem at all." You get a picture, and then somebody else will come over to you and go, "I know I'm supposed to know who you are, but I don't." And you're like,
"Why are you coming up to
why
me?
Why would you do that? Why would you go out of your way to?" Tell somebody you don't know them. Am I supposed to know who you are? And I go, no, you're not supposed to know who I am. So there's that other level of arseholery out there as well.
I remember my brother who's a dickhead sometimes to people. He won't mind me saying that, but he went up to Glen Hansard was doing a sign-in in Galway, and he went up and he went, "Your music is terrible and I think you're a dick." And Glen went, "Thanks very much, buddy." Stephen came home and was like, "Do you know what? He was actually pretty nice." I was like, "Why would you do that? Why would you go up to somebody and do that?" You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, at least he had the courage to say it to his face and didn't just take to Twitter. Do you know what I mean? Often the criticism of Twitter is, don't tweet what you wouldn't say to someone's face. So fair play to your brother. Fair play to your brother for being a dickhead in person.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the social media version of that is very much not only targeted towards celebrities, but targeted towards maybe organizations who post something that person is not interested in. And then their reply is, "Who cares?" And it's like, "Why are you replying to this thing? Why do you keep publishing stories about this? Stop talking about this." And it's like, thankfully.
And that's a classic.
Yeah, it is.
That's a classic Dave from Love Island his relationship has ended with Mary or something. No, sorry, David and Mary are two very glamorous names for Love Island, but you know what I'm saying. David's relationship has ended with Mary, and then people reply with, "Who? What? Am I supposed to know who these are?" And they're like, "Oh, look, go off and read your alt-right fucking website."
Well, it's that's the sphere that David Brent is now existing in. He's gone to a whole new plane. Like, he comes back to the office then, as you say, not with the dog at the start. There is this sort of awkwardness when he comes back between himself and Gareth, the sort of phone ahead line, yeah. And he's like, "I'm not going to phone ahead. You're not a doctor," sort of thing. And then there is, like, I love Gareth in this moment when he's talking about leading a bunch of men to their certain death. And he says, "Please come with me." He's like, "I'm not going to say, please come with me. I'll tell you a joke. If you're laughing in the jungle, you're going to give away your position to the enemy." And this sort of embracing of his new role as an army leader, it's like... Like, when you think about Gareth, Eric, is he up near the top of your favourite Office characters? Because he is clearly the one that's probably most Marmite to people.
Oh, he is. Like, Mackenzie Crook's so good in that role. Beautifully played. Pitch perfect, tone perfect. Every moment, he doesn't miss a beat. The fact, as you just alluded to there, the fact that he is now in the role that Brent once occupied as he's managing the branch, Or as Brent likes to point out, it's a watered-down version of his previous role. It's not as senior as the role he once had. I think that, and in that exchange between him and Gareth, when Gareth is saying, you know, "You should have called ahead," there's like, it's just car crash cringe after car crash cringe. Like, it's one after the other there in the space of like a minute, and it's so cringing and awkward. And like, I mean, you'll come out of that scene with a six-pack. You're cringing that hard, you know. It's so good.
But it goes so on for good. So long as well. It's just that, like, I'm not gonna call ahead. Yeah, I'm gonna call. No, not. No, you need to call it. No, just let it go.
Yeah. And then there's a silence, a little drawn out silence, and then he'll come back with it again. "You really should have called it." "No, I'm not gonna call ahead." Ah, you're like, "Oh my god, stop. But Mackenzie Crook as Gareth is just amazing. Like,
he's a brilliant actor, isn't he?
He's so good, absolutely brilliant. But you also mentioned, like, when Brent walks into the office. At the start of that scene, Tim locks him in the office, and he tries to get the receptionist. And I think it's quite interesting that the receptionist kind of looks like Dawn as well. She's blonde, similar style.
A new Dawn.
And that's a beautiful line from Brent, in fairness, and one of his better lines, because he often puts out the cringy crap lines. But that was one of his better lines, "A New Dawn." And the fact that she doesn't engage in the horseplay with Tim is another sad moment. And it's another yearning for better days, another yearning for Dawn. And you can see Tim just break up a little bit inside again. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, she is one of those people who just happens to share the same carpet as him and walking the same carpet for 8 hours, and that kind of like plays into the mad coincidence of being able to exist in the same sphere of Dawn, and that's why I think we're quite emotionally attached to what happens at the end. Right, the next bit, Eric, I'm going to let you take the lead here. He talks to us about his £42,000 that he spent in a single, and then we see the music video. What can you say about this?
This is, you know, all this information comes from Gareth. When Brent was made redundant, and he sued, and was successfully. They settled out of court. You don't find out how much it's for, but Gareth says, "Tell him what you spent it on." I don't have to, and he tell him what he spent it on. Spent on music. I spent it on a music video, and he spent all of the money on a music video. I tell him how much he made. Gareth is poking him in the background, telling him what, revealing. Brent and really hurting him, even though Brent is reluctant to give out this information. And basically what he's done is he spent the whole 42 grand that he won the settlement on producing a single and a video, an accompanying video. And the single is If You Don't Know Me. It's not a Simply Red song. I think it is, isn't it? It's a Simply Red song.
I'm not quite sure, but it definitely exists, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cover version of If You Don't Know Me by Now. And it is just... Oh my God! The music video is Brent dressed in white,
barefoot,
Rele- releasing doves off the landing in a house and having this blazing row with this stunningly beautiful woman who's at least a foot taller than him. And it is just, oh my God, it is just cringe fest central. And it is, you know, I think if people were to go away and think about what kind of music video Brent would have, I think most people would arrive that it would be something similar to what was shown. Mm. It was just, what did you think of it, Alan?
Oh my God, it's just so, what I actually, rewatching it, I haven't seen this episode in so long, and I'd forgotten about the voice. The voice, like, I mean, like when he starts the lip sync, and it's like, holy crap, this is incredible. I think that's a bit that kind of takes me by surprise, but also the ability to, it's like, it's not something that The Office really do, you know, it's like according to something that's that absurd, like it is usually kept within the confines of documentary. Yes. And it's like, whoa, we're being transported here to something that we haven't seen too often. Whoa, what is going on here? it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. We move things on then, and like, I mean, he is now really starting to layer it on with his unwelcomed nature in The Office. He's talking about Dr. Dre and Ice-T being the equivalent of Wordsworth as he's back in the office, and on a more recent trip, Neil is there and thereabouts, telling him to just like basically stay away. I hope you're not distracting people from their work. And we start to kind of go on the road a little bit more with David at this point. He's talking about his mobile office. If you've got a mobile phone, you're in the office, he says. Like, I mean, there's a little bit of working from home poignancy about that, what you get in the year 2021 for sure. And then there is the situation where he's back in the office once again with Neil and with Gareth, and they're talking about who David is going to bring to the party. Do you have a girlfriend? And it's like, of course you do. And there is this genuinely brilliant, awful but brilliant lad chat that then develops where he's like talking about Neil is talking about his girlfriend, and there's some sort of derogatory remark made, and David is like, to grade into a GP, well done, congratulations. And
yes, like he looks at her, and Neil shows her a picture, and obviously she's quite an attractive woman, because Brent, if you notice, looks at the photograph and then looks back. And he's like, you know, I prefer my women intelligent, is what he says. And she goes, well, she's a doctor. Oh, objectifying GPs, that's not very PC, is it? That's not very nice. And it's again, it exposes Brent as being this pathetic loser with no... Like in that scene again, is it Finchy that's there in that scene with them?
I think
it's Finchy. And he always seems to kind of man up when Finchy's there and try to be the alpha male when Finchy's there. And it's, you know, but in other moments, you'll see Brent, and when he's with women, he is quite gentle. He's quite vulnerable. But when he's with Finchy, he puts on this alpha male exterior and tries to be one of the lads, and comes up with a lot of attempted, but often failing, locker room talk with Finchy, and tries to engage in that with Finchy, and just fails miserably again and again. The cringe comes.
Yeah, like that sort of stuff doesn't really come naturally to David Brent, as much as he is like people will say, oh, he's a horrible man. It is that tough exterior that he's trying to portray that is leading to those awful moments, not an actual reflection of his character. Like, is that giving him a get out of jail free card?
Perhaps. But I think we get to see him at all moments. We see him challenged at every time. Mm-hmm. The horrible alpha male exterior is only reserved for when Finchie's around or when he's trying to be one of the boys. And sometimes with Gareth, he'll do that as well. But we see him alone a lot. We see his real feelings when he's not being as performative to the camera as he quite often is. We see the moments where he looks extremely vulnerable, and that's the moments when you go, oh my God, your heart kind of goes out to him, and you want him to succeed.
And then he's like, kind of like, it is a juxtaposition between those talking head moments from David Brent and the laddish moments from David Brent, where he says, yeah, I have girlfriends on and off, where that laddishness is kind of like turned down a little bit, but while he's a talking head, and like he's obviously asked, when do you think you will be in a relationship? He's like, I don't ask when, I ask who and why, which is just a beautiful line. So what do you make of the lad exterior of David Brent that he likes to push?
Like, it always kind of brings you back to the, this guy's just a dickhead. The dates in particular, like the bit where he walks into the I think it's the third date, and he walks into the bar and she's behind him, he just goes, oh, for fuck's sake.
What a moment. What a moment.
He's giving out about how shit she is. Like, it's just, and then he, like, I think that's amazing. I think that's what's brilliant about the writing and what's brilliant about Richard Gervais is that, like, you flip so quickly from the, oh, what a complete asshole, to, oh God, this poor guy, he needs a hug. Like,
yeah.
I don't know who would be able to achieve that. But what I also like about it is he's kind of this realistic character. He's not like, he's not all good or he's not all bad. He has his faults and he's probably not the best guy the best of times, but he's still, on occasion, tries his best. And like, that's what I love about the, at the end when he tells Finchie, is it to fuck off? And you're just like, yeah, okay, yes. There is good in there. And he is just, like, you do feel like it's a front a lot of the time to just feel like he's part of the crew and part of the guys. And, but underneath it, he's probably just a really kind of lonely guy. That's what really upsets me about The Office. It's sad. Like, there's so much of it that's really, really sad.
You know? I wasn't sure when to bring this comparison in, but I think that was actually a good time. It was going to happen at some point, the US versus the UK Office. Now, Eric, I'll hold my hands up here and say I've always professed myself to be more of a US Office fan. I will say rewatching this has challenged that substantially. I just think these two episodes are absolutely sublime. And I think when you go for like an hour and a half of straight up comedy, I don't think the US Office has a consecutive 90 minutes or whatever. It's probably 100 minutes of comedy. That is as good as this. This is like perfect, these two episodes. But I also think after season one, I'm not sure how much you've watched of it, but they move away from the David Brent type character with Michael Scott, and they make this guy a more sanitized version of himself. And those moments of loneliness are kind of unbelievably wild moments of comedy. So like, there's one scene where he's got his girlfriend who clearly hates him, and there is this moment where she's like, we don't even share a bed, he sleeps on the little thing at the end of the bed, and it's like, that's obviously hilarious because he like curls up at the end of the bed, and it's like, that's just a great moment of comedy, but it's kind of so ridiculous and so far-fetched. Whereas with David Brent, it's kind of like, Jesus, this is like so normal, or so I could see this happening. Like, as you say, the roadside cafes, where he doesn't need to say anything, just a wide shot of him sitting there at nighttime on his own, eating a takeaway meal in a food court. There is something far more authentic about what David Brent is compared to what Michael Scott becomes after one season of the US Office.
100% agree with you on, and I love the American Office as well, but I just have a special place in my heart for the UK Office, and that's why it'll always be my favourite. And as you just mentioned there, the two episodes together, when you watch them back to back, it's just, it's good for your soul. I think it's good. You laugh, you cry, you get angry, you're so sympathetic towards Brent, and then he goes and says something, and you're like, ah, for fuck's sake, Dave, I'll just say that for you. You fucking ruined it. We're doing so well. And you want to punch him sometimes, you know. But then, as Sue said, you want to hug him another time. But yeah, it's the reason it hits home so hard is because it is so normal and you identify with it so much. As you said, with the Steve Carell character, it's become almost more of a caricature of himself, as opposed to real life, real. I don't know. I can't find the words to express what I'm trying to say. But you did it well there on a few minutes ago.
I think it's also like, it may just come down to the simple fact that the original Office is not very long. There's not that many episodes. Whereas with the US Office, there are a shitload of episodes. And even I know Michael Scott leaves, but it's still what, 5-6 seasons of him there. Like, that is a lot of television to keep up that pace. And maybe after season 2 or 3, it does start to slip a little bit from certain characters' perspectives. And also as well, you got Ricky Gervais, who's so centrally involved in this. I know Carell is as well in the US one, but it just feels like he is writing for himself. And it's just a match made in heaven. And the more the more I kind of rewatch this, maybe it's just not being as young as I was when I watched the US Office, the more I'm like, hold on, have I got this wrong? Have I actually completely got this thing wrong? That actually, yes, the US Office is great, but really, did it make me feel that way when I was watching the UK Office and the Christmas episode? I'm not sure. Anyway, well, the next scene up after the lad chat in the office with the boys is the introduction of my favorite character, which is Peter, his agent. I love this guy. Oh. I think he's just such a pathetic. He's just a lame duck of a character in there. He offers nothing in such a deliberate way. The sort of when he's
nothing. Doesn't even know his own clients' names.
Like, what sort of agency do you run, Peter? Oh well, a bit of everything. It's kind of like when you ask like a 15-year-old, what sort of music are you into? It's like, oh, you know, listen to a bit of everything.
He's real rapid in headlights, isn't he? Because I love, you know, when you see agents, what's the name of that really famous boxing agent?
Eddie Hearn, yeah.
And he's able to just command the camera all the time. And then you compare him with him and you're like, is this guy an agent?
That's completely it. So he is like a rabbit caught in the headlights. He's just very self-aware when the camera's on him and he's being asked a question. Is that they're asking me a question? Am I on the television? You can almost hear his internal dialogue here, you know. But yeah, like, and what were his clients again? He had
Michael Douglas. Oh, yeah. Michael thinking Douglas. About getting a catch and Zeta Jones.
Because they think it's just some old guy hanging around at a party.
Yeah,
so good.
And Brent is like,
he calls him Kirk Douglas first, doesn't he? Kirk Douglas. Yeah. And it's Brent who has to correct him. No, it's Michael Douglas. Oh, yeah, sorry, Michael Douglas. Like, he doesn't even know his own client's names.
It's like he's Kirk Douglas' son. And Michael's like, so what does he do? And Peter, the agent, is like, yeah, you just wander around looking like Michael Douglas. Like, I mean, and then the sort of, again, one of these awful moments for the ego of Brent. Do you have any of these lookalikes to be so I don't need to turn up to these things? And he's like, you're nowhere near famous enough to have a looky like you. And like, Brent's like, you're supposed to big me up, man. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Just plead with him. Yeah.
Plead with him. Yeah.
What you say that for? What you say that for?
and this is where we get into these foot in mouth public appearances.
These are the ones that actually made this, because I texted on last night, they said I wanted to crawl out of my own skin. Those two moments, the blind date one and the one where he's just like, it's just, well, what are you supposed to do? I'm just gonna wave.
So what have we got planned tonight? Well, I'm just gonna wave. You're just gonna wave. Yeah.
Oh, nobody clapping for him when he goes on the stage. You're just like, no, make this stop.
Yeah, it is. Like, it is kind of a grim reflection of this, like, post-Cool Britannia phase in English life, where it's like, let's give a big mumbles jumbles welcome to David Brent. And it's like, feeling hot, hot, hot. And it's like, this is just all awful. This is awful. Like, why? Why is he here?
And he steps onto the stage by accident as well, and then steps back and is like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. But the blind date bit too, as you mentioned, is
kills me.
Oh, wow.
Kills me.
It's Bubble from Big Brother. Mm-hmm. And the guy who does, is it the Halifax ads?
Yeah, the Halifax ads, yeah.
Yeah. And then Brent, of course, not only is trying so hard that he wants the crowd to love him so much that he thinks that by dressing up as Austin Powers, that will provide the comedic effect to make them love him and laugh. And he just walks out as Austin Powers. And they're all just looking at him going, what are you doing, you idiot? And he's like, oh, he's, yeah, I know, look at me. I'm like, I'm crazy, am I? And they're like, oh, no. And then Bubble from Big Brother makes a really lewd joke to the contestant who's behind the screen in the old blind date, still a black format, and about blowing to know I'm happy, she's got a blow bubble.
Yeah.
And he goes, doesn't work because the same as blowing bubbles. So you're talking about blow job there, so doesn't really work. And it's just complete silence. The crowd just looking at him. It's like, oh no.
What are you feeling from your own personal standpoint there? Because I'm sure, like, either you've been waiting to go on stage and you've seen people struggle. I'm not sure if you've seen it from your own perspective before, but like, it does feel, oh my God, this is like nail scraping on a chalkboard sort of moment. Like, is it too far-fetched, or have you been like, this feels similar to something I've experienced myself?
alone, like, you know, as a comedian, it's great when the previous comedian has died on stage.
To put it bluntly.
That's the quote that's coming out of this.
But no, that's not fair. It's actually not true either. It's not true either, to be honest with you, because you want the comedian to be good, but not really brilliant, but yeah, good, to keep them going, get them laughing, to oil them up a little bit for your performance. But when I see a comedian on stage who's dying, it is horrible. I can't watch. And some people love it. Like, another comedian will go, come here, quick, watch this. And you're like, no, I can't. And that's the feeling I get when I see Brent, and particularly in those moments, the public appearances. It's car crash. It's horrific. Mm.
There is the fish out of water scenario here as well, with the sort of mumbo jumbos and that particular club. Like, I'm not saying that there has ever been a crowd for David Brent, but this maybe is not the crowd for David Brent. Like, I'm sure there's times where you've seen, not necessarily Austin Powers, but certain material that may be better than Austin Powers, and it's just not connecting with the audience, and it's like, this is a match made in hell. Because that's essentially what it's all about.
Yeah, they're like, I mean, and that's quite, that's another thing that a lot of comedians will say to each other, particularly to a comedian who's walked off stage and it's been a really bad gig. And you'll just go, they just weren't your crowd.
Mm.
as opposed to saying, my God, you were rubbish tonight. I'm giving it to them honestly, like, you know. In that instance, but I mean, as you say, Owen, what is the classic David Brent crowd? Where would David Brent? But actually, I don't know, we'll probably cover it in the very last scene. There is a beautiful moment at the very end where he does crack a joke or do an impression, and everyone laughs.
Yeah.
And you can see him just, oh my God, they're actually laughing. Because in all the whole series, yeah, he nails it. His timing was perfect. And everyone's like, oh my God, that was funny. Because the whole two series, he struggled. He cracks jokes. They're all crap jokes, in fairness. And nobody laughs. And that's the comedy of watching it, the beauty of the cringe. But in that moment at the end, when he does the joke and everyone laughs, it's another beautiful moment.
You can imagine that he's going to eat out in that for a long time afterwards, though. Like, he's telling everybody about the time that he cracked a great joke at the Christmas party. You're just like, oh, geez.
And he'll be continuously doing Frank Spencer impressions for the rest of his life because of it.
It worked once.
Yeah.
What a beautiful little mechanic to finish the entire series off on. What a genius move. It's like, I'm not sure how they planned it all along, but to deliberately sketch it so that nobody would ever laugh at him. Even in the American one, you'd have Dwight sucking up to Michael by laughing at him. You don't have that with Gareth in this. You don't have him sucking up to him too much by laughing. It's always kind of like a different sort of relationship to a point. And then at the end, he finally makes somebody laugh, and it's the entire office. It's a really happy ending.
Oh, it's a superb book ending. It's incredible, absolutely incredible. But I think it's just those last couple of minutes of that last episode is you do see this growth in Brent as a character, and a little bit more of self-awareness, and, you know, we'll save it for later, but the, you know, the date at the Christmas party and how well it goes and all that kind of thing. It's those last couple of minutes you really do see a growth, and it's like the classic story, isn't it? Like, it's like our hero wins in the end, kind of thing, like, you know. That's what it is.
Yeah, but there, it really does, like, you know, when people say, oh, there's somebody for everyone, you get to the end, you're like, there really, really is somebody for everyone.
Yeah.
If David Brent could find somebody, like, she must be the only woman on the planet who finds him. Like, when he starts dancing in the office, you're like, no. And she's like joining in, you're like, what is happening?
Yeah. He's doing the struts and the moves and the hip movements. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. You're like, no, David, don't. Oh my God, she's going with it. You're doing so well.
What are your emotions, Sue, at that final scene in the first episode when beer gets thrown and a few tough words are had backstage?
Oh God, it's just so depressing, isn't it? Like, you know, the way I love the way they play that camera shot as well, where they just like go in and go back out and go in and go back out, and they do it a few times and just leave it, and you're like, fucking hell, this is a, like, so easy. Your man says, have you got any change? He's like, get it out of the money.
Yeah.
It's just like,
oh yeah, was that my beer?
And I just, the moment where your one spills, the bit where he goes and you're like, I can do this. He goes to like throw it on. She throws it back at him. You're just like, this is just a fucking disaster.
And it just keeps on going.
And he says, I was already wet. The joke's on you.
What? What? It's like six.
Yeah,
right, but there's something so sad about it, because I feel like he thinks that this is the road for him that's going to work, and then it doesn't, and then he's just standing in a room going, I've nothing, there's nothing now, there's no, I've no office, I've been barred, I've no career, like it's just, it's desperately sad, like that last shot is desperately sad.
Yeah, that's real kind of UK office rawness, that nothing else can really kind of come close to that end of the episode. Like, just to kind of touch on the other bits that I just wanted to mention from the first part of this two episodes run. We haven't mentioned Anne, who is Tim's new desk neighbor, talking about skipping the line at Space Mountain, talking about having a word with the French guy. She is Brexit, all wrapped up into one individual. And then we have the scene where she's talking about the Kama Sutra and the sex positions, how she managed to get herself impregnated. And it's just like, that is spectacular awkwardness is what I would say. I think she's a horrible, horrible person. And I will say, when the lads have a pop offer in the second episode, it's like, screw you. Whereas Tim is like, yeah, you know what, leave her off, let her go, let her leave the room and cry herself out of this party.
Someone should have went after her. It was like, I know she's annoying, but for fuck's sake, they were assholes.
Yeah.
Oh, that Glenn guy, that part of that Neil, oh, sorry, the Lee posse is despicable humans. Like, they are the alpha male Brexit English football hooligan supporting cretins that we all deplore, you know. That actress who plays Anne, like, what a performance. Mm. Like just her physicality as well. And you know, the holding the facts to Tim's face, not looking at him. You sure about this? You sure about this? She's typing away with the other hand and she's not looking at him. And he goes, Yeah. Oh, is that right? Well, the wrong date is on it. You know, this kind of moments. Yeah. And like, you go, oh my God, that's such a brilliant performance of an absolute asshole.
Yeah.
but having her pregnant is another brilliant move by the office and the writers, is because you're kind of going, like, as Sue said, you don't know, she is an asshole and you want to hate her, but at the same time, you're kind of going, yeah, but she's pregnant, you know, hormones maybe, I don't know, maybe she's not really like that, you know, I don't know, let's give her the benefit of the doubt kind of thing. But when that Glenn guy says that to her at the end, I do agree, I think Tim should have maybe got up after her or sent someone after her.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And that was the only moment I think Tim let himself down.
Who is... Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Who is the best actor in The Office?
So many.
Freeman.
I would have thought Freeman from my untrained eye, yeah. But
Freeman is incredible. Yeah.
I just go back to the central character. I know it's an easy one to go for, but I just think Gervais's performance is just incredible. Every moment, there's nothing wasted. It's just sublime, absolutely sublime.
Gervais, like, his understanding of where the camera is for the documentary is unbelievable. Like, his looks around the room and his eyes back and the way he looks at the camera, like, all of that stuff is just, like, that timing must be so incredibly hard to do. And it's just flawless. You don't even realize he's thinking about all that stuff all the time. Besides all of his lines and jokes, like, he's amazing.
Like, it's technically perfect too. Absolutely, as you say. Sorry, maybe that's what I like, as an actor's performance, you know, there's so many great performances in it. But I suppose what I'm basing it on is not only just the acting, but the awareness of the camera, the little eye movements, the little glances, the double takes. Oh, everything about it is just absolutely pitch perfect, and that's why I would have Gervais as the best in that. Yeah, it's an easy option, I know, but
no. But sometimes the most obvious one is the answer in these things. One other scene really that I know Sue you adore in this first episode is the meeting before the Christmas party, and the list of the things that you need at a meeting.
Oh God, I love this scene.
Disco girls, wet t-shirt competition.
Something for old people to do.
Yeah.
We're not having wet, We're not having old people doing the wet t-shirt competition. Yeah.
Because I text that to Owen earlier. It just popped into my head and I remembered how funny it was. Don't have old people do the wet t-shirt competition. It's so good.
It is absolutely magnificent. Like, I mean, it's I think we're pretty much wrapped up the first episode there. There isn't as much to go through in the second episode, but it's just this phenomenal thing. Except, sorry, there is one other thing. One last thing I promise from episode one is the setting up the dating profile. Are you not attractive? Are you quite attractive? Are you attractive or very attractive? And he's like, oh, very attractive is a little bit too arrogant. It's like, you know, like. What are you into, traveling? And then I love the whole line. I think that's actually a moment when David Brent is genuinely funny and not just being a cringe funny. That's like the moment when he makes me laugh at an actual good one, when he's like, how do you think I got the hull? Hull came to me, hull came down the motorway in a car. It's like,
and he doesn't even play for it. Like, he doesn't actually realize that that's actually the funny line. That's what I love about that. It just goes on.
But also, they ask him about what would you consider yourself, well built, heavily built. Yeah. And Garrett just glances down at his belly and goes, heavily built. I go, no. Well built. It's, stop. I can't cope.
I think that kind of wraps up episode one. As I say, episode two, we've kind of already touched on a lot of what occurs here. This is a series of dates, essentially, for David Brent. We've touched on a couple of them already. And there is just this mad coincidence at the very end that there is somebody that David Brent is attracted to who seems to be attracted to him. And I think part of that is that she is just accepting of the patronizing tone that comes with every sentence that he says. You know, the conversation they have around the documentary, and David Brent is like, I don't know if you understand television, but this is what happens when a documentary is made. They leave certain things out. She's like, oh, you headbutted a woman. And when she's still there afterwards, you know that the deal is sealed, and he was going to be a happy man.
And the bit that didn't make it into was his beautiful rendition of the Bob Marley song, No Women, No Cry. And even the black guy in the office said it was a beautiful, so therefore it should have been kept in. It should have made the edit. But I think the character that he eventually hooks up with, you're delighted for him. You're so happy for him. But this is the thing with Brent. Prior to that lady arriving at the Christmas party in a taxi, do you remember the other woman who arrived? And a slightly bigger woman. And it's another moment where he went, oh, for fuck. And she goes, she's looking for someone else at the party. And he goes, oh, yeah, wow, phew, she's upstairs. Wow, I was on a blind date and I thought it was you. And you're like, you fucking idiot. What did you say that for? And like, you're rooting for him 1 minute and then you're hating him the next minute. And you're going, you don't deserve happiness. Mm. But then that woman arrives and you're still happy for him.
I love these Christmas party moments where it is just him being awkward, just standing around waiting for things to happen. Everybody just existing with their little glasses of wine and just having a really crap time. And decent music is playing, actually, but everybody's just having an awful time. You're on
fucking forced to go to these things. Yeah. We went to not that the off the ball parties wouldn't be absolutely hysterical crack all the time, but we had to go and get finger food and stuff. And there's that awkward thing. No matter, like, me and Owen sit across from each other in the office, right? But even outside of that, there is that awkward thing where you're all shoved into a room. And you have to all have finger food together and talk about how great Christmas is. And it's so awkward.
I love it. I don't know about you, Sue. I love awkwardness and I love finger food. My two favorite things.
I purposely go into those parties about an hour late so that everyone's nicely oiled. I'm like, yes, now we can just all have chats like normal people. We don't feel like we have to be forced. And that's what so much that Christmas party is, like, people that have never spoken to each other before.
It's an interesting thing, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
as you said, people that you work with every day, you spend that 8 hours a day, you spend more time with them than you do your family, and yet when you're pushed into that social situation, you're dead right, Sue. Things can be a little bit
Because you have to talk about outside of work, yeah. You suddenly have to talk about your personal life and get to know somebody outside of a work environment. It just becomes weird all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, is this going to be a reflection of where we're all at as individuals when we go back to the pub for the first time this summer? Eric, is this going to be, are we actually watching future us when we look at Martin Freeman awkwardly shuffling beside people in his office?
Well, I tell you something, Owen, after this pandemic, when I go to the pub, I will be hugging every single individual in that pub. I probably will be for the foreseeable future. but there's the social awkwardness as well is beautifully shown as well by Gareth. He attempts to talk to two co-workers who are probably in their 50s, and they're both having a conversation with drinks, and he's like, "How you doing, lads?"
Yeah.
And tries to get in, they just kind of dismiss him, and he's just left there and just looks around and sees somebody else at the party, calls over to him and starts doing a monkey impression and walks over to them kind of thing.
It's that horrible manager thing as well, where there's a kind of a, oh, you have to talk to all the staff. Staff don't want to talk to you.
Oh, I know. You see the manager, you're bolting the other side of the room, aren't you? Yeah.
can I put one thing to you? At the end of this episode, obviously, we've already touched on the ending. We started with the end, really. But up until that point, obviously, we have this really beautiful moment where Dawn opens her secret Santa gift. It is clearly from Tim, and it's an oil painting. It says, "Never give up," or whatever it is. What would you have thought had she not come back, or had we not seen that she comes back, that we still have the group picture and David Brent makes everybody laugh, but we don't have her coming back, but we have her crying in the taxi and he's sitting in the front. Would it have been better if we had actually made our mind up for ourselves, that we had that sort of very sad cliffhanger that we weren't quite sure? Or do you like the fact that it was tied up?
Yeah, I know what you're saying now. And sometimes you're better left leaving an audience wondering and making up their own conclusions. But I just thought, again, it was a superb bookend for the show. There were so many bookends to the show when you think about it. It was something we all longed for as an audience throughout the whole series, the two series. And it's such, again, many times, it's not often you say that about a comedy, so many beautiful moments, but a beautiful, heart-wrenching moment when she's in the back of that taxi and Lee's passed out in the front, and she opens the present and it's clearly a gift from Tim, because it's the caricature, the sketch she's drawn of him. And what is it? Don't give up. He wrote along with the oil set. And it's like when you see that, like, your heart just bursts. You're like, oh my God. And it's in that moment she realizes she's doing the wrong thing. She's wasted her life, this complete waster in the front of the cab. And I don't know. Now, to me, I think it's such another beautiful moment where Tim is engaged in this completely crap office speak with Ricky Gervais and Mackenzie Crook. And in the background, you see Dawn walking into the office. And you're like, oh my God, oh my God. She's there. And the tears are still in her eyes. And he's still carried away. He's completely oblivious to her presence. He's still carried away to talk. And she just touched his arm. And he turns around. And it's like, oh my God! It's up there with Officer and Gentleman stuff. It's square. Get in. Get in. Get stuck in. It's brilliant. I'm the better person for seeing that scene play out, I have to say.
Yeah, no, when you put it like that, now I'm starting to think about it, I'm like, actually, it's the emotion isn't just when she gets the present, the emotion is when she comes back and there is a payoff. I think you have to pay that off. And I'm sure that was a conversation, because as time has told us, they weren't bullshitting us when they said this was going to be the end of The Office. Here we are 18 years later, almost 18 years later, and still no reunion. They haven't gone Gavin and Stacey on it. Is that something you'd like to see? Or friends?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't given it. I love the fact that it ended when it did. I think probably the year after it ended, I would have been wishing for another series, or, you know, let's come on, let's catch, or even 2 or 3 years later. But now so much time has passed, I'm kind of happy that they left it as it is. But having said that, if they were to say, we're doing a one-off Christmas special to see where all... I mean, who wouldn't want to see what Brent's up to right now? you know. Yeah. So
sometimes I think those series, like, I thought it was a genius decision to just say we're done, because it's brave, especially if it's something that's huge and the BBC love it and the audience love it. Like, I know it was kind of slow to take off, but it's just one of those series that everyone says is one of the best. But I think Graham Lenehan series are like that as well. The IT Crowd, Father Ted, just finishing on highs and going out. I just think it doesn't leave a bad taste. It leaves a great legacy. It's something that you can go back and go, that was perfect. It finished exactly when it was supposed to finish.
Faulty Towers is another example as well.
Yeah. When they extend those series, it just, like, I'm really skeptical about that Friends reunion. I'm just like, I don't, and I loved Friends, but I just think it's a bit too late now. I think I just want them to exist at that time when I was that age.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
So it's interesting. It's probably, Friends maybe can get away with it because it's already a pretty long season, or long series, I should say. And it's like, what's another few episodes on it? And I don't know. I just find The Office is like a little bit more complicated or easier to get wrong because it's coming off such a height. Like, I'll definitely have it on a much higher peak than Friends, for example. But that's just my opinion. I just think that it's far superior to a lot of comedy out there, and it's just so hard to do it right again. But yeah, Father Ted and the IT Crowd came to mind as well. Just one other note before we wrap up. Did you know that the plot lines in this episode all got leaked before Christmas 2003? Somebody in the BBC got an address. Somebody in the BBC got an address wrong while posting out a script. And the November, so this goes out on the 26th and 27th of December 2003. That November, a beauty technician called Joanne Hiley claimed to have been sent the scripts in the post by mistake. So although, like, technically illegal, she announced to The Sun that she intended to sell them. And sure enough, it did get published. The Daily Mail bought the scripts and revealed pretty much all the plot points in an article which was published 4 weeks before the broadcast. And Gervais did a few interviews. He asked for a newspaper or magazine to buy the scripts and return them to the BBC as a little Christmas present to the nation. But no, it was published. They did not reveal that Tim and Dawn would get together at the end. That was the only detail they left out. But everything else was like, here you go, jazz hands.
At least
hands.
They left that out. Jeez. Yeah.
Oh, was that a decision by the newspapers to leave that bit out?
It must have been, because I don't see the reason to publish everything except for that little detail. So I'm
like, well, I've never been so happy not to read the Daily Mail.
Oh, it's just awful. Like, I remember Breaking Bad as well. Like, I was late to Breaking Bad, so I was about two episodes behind the last episode, and it was just kind of everywhere. And it really ruins it. Like, something that's that big, you know, and you're really waiting for the end, it just ruins it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this has been Let's Go Back to The Office Christmas Specials, episode 13 and 14. If you want to check it out, it is on Netflix at the moment. Eric, first of all, thank you for suggesting this. It was a joyful experience to be able to watch this back. What's next for you over the next few months as life gets back to some semblance of normality?
Well, hoping to get back doing some gigs. There's been a few bookings for the months ahead, which fills me with joy. I did a gig last week, during the week, but it was one of these gigs where you record to camera, and I was supposed to do a little short 10-minute set, and I completely forgot how to do comedy, and I just stood there looking at the microphone going, well, what am I supposed to do here again? And my sense of timing, rhythm, everything was gone. So before I do those gigs for the next few months, I shall be practicing in the mirror with a hairbrush like I did as a kid, pretending I was a rock star.
God, you need the audience though, don't you? Like,
that is another thing as well.
Yeah,
it's so difficult to do a routine and come in with a punchline and there's nothing.
Yeah
And you're like, whereas in a live setting, you're rolling with it and you're laughing with it. You might even point out somebody's laughing and have a bit of interaction with the crowd. All of that kind of fuels you. But it's, look, come here. It's just the way things are at the moment. It won't be like that forever. We're nearly there, folks. Hang in there.
Absolutely. You're like a sports person coming back. It's like the first few days of the Premier League when there was a load of shots missed and people couldn't find the back of the net for love nor money. So that's
exactly.
It. Keep training, and looking forward to seeing you soon in real life and seeing you on stage soon as well. Eric, it's been great chatting to you. Thanks a million for coming on. This has been
Let's
Go Back to, and you can check us out on Spotify or on the Go Loud app, which is where you can get us as ever. Every week we go back and watch a film or TV show that has a particular meaning for that week's special guest. We'll chat to you next time. Bye-bye.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.